From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. This year marks the first confirmed case of West Nile virus in the United States. This week marks the first confirmed case of West Nile virus in the United States this year. With all the rain this spring, scientists are predicting a bumper crop of mosquitoes for the summer. Mosquitoes transmit the virus to people, so this summer could be even worse than last for West Nile infections. Here to talk about what the summer may hold is Stephen Ostroff, Deputy Director of the National Center for Infectious Diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Dr. Ostroff, welcome back to Science Friday.
Nice to talk to you.
And I'd like our listeners to know that they're welcome to call in with their questions about West Nile virus. Our number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-TALK. So I've said that this week was the first West Nile virus confirmed case, but as I understand, this man had been sick earlier in the summer.
That's correct. The information that we have about his illness is that he actually was ill about a month or so ago, and because of some of the vagaries of the testing, the fact that the specimens were initially tested in a commercial laboratory and then had to be forwarded to us for confirmation, there was a little bit of a delay in terms of confirming the diagnosis. We're also aware that there are several other cases in various stages of confirmation, but I think it's important to point out that it wouldn't be at all unexpected based on our experience with West Nile over the last couple of years. This is indeed the time of year where we would expect to start seeing an increase in the number of human cases occurring.
Let's go back a little, actually, and let's talk about what the symptoms of West Nile are and how it's transmitted.
Sure. West Nile has several different forms that it takes. The form that we're obviously most concerned about is when it produces either a meningitis or an encephalitis, which is a swelling within the brain. However, the more common form of West Nile is what we call West Nile fever, which is a fairly mild, nonspecific illness that manifests with headache, fever, muscle aches, that lasts a couple of days and then tends to go away. The difference in terms of the more severe forms of the disease is that they can start out the same way, and then after a variable degree of time, sometimes fairly rapidly and sometimes after a period of a few days, progress to these more severe symptoms where people start experiencing very severe headache along with fever, and in some instances can become somewhat somnolent, have very severe muscle aches associated with that, sometimes back aches, and in some cases it can progress to seizures, muscle weakness, and in some cases frank paralysis and coma. So the spectrum of illness can be quite wide, but what we're most concerned about is the more severe forms of the illness. The other thing that we do know is that there seems to be a direct correlation between age and the likelihood that after a mosquito bite and an infection with this particular virus, there's a direct correlation with how likely the severe form of the disease is to develop and age. In that if we look at the experience from last year, among the identified cases that had the milder West Nile fever, their average age was about 48 years. For those that developed the more severe forms of illness, the average age was 59 years. And amongst the individuals that ended up with fatal illness, their average age was 78 years. And this has been a consistent feature since West Nile was first identified.
Right. And as to how it's transmitted, you don't give West Nile to the person in the room with you. There has to be a mosquito involved.
That's correct. There's no person-to-person transmission. The reservoir host in nature for this particular virus is birds. However, birds, for the most part, do not directly transmit the virus from the bird to a human, or the other incidental host would be horses. There has to be the intermediate, which is the mosquito. And it's the mosquito that either transfers the virus from bird to bird, or if you unfortunately get in the way of that mosquito before it finds another bird, and you happen to be a human or you happen to be a horse, some of these mosquitoes will also bite horses and humans, and then transmits the virus to those species as well.
Well, I count myself in the human category, and last summer, I live in Washington, D.C., and last summer there were all kinds of, I saw a couple of dead crows in my neighborhood, and then I came down with a couple days of an illness, just like you were describing, this milder form of the West Nile fever, achy, headache, and I wasn't even serious enough to go to the doctor, but I'm wondering now if there's any way that I can find out whether I was exposed to West Nile virus.
Yes and no. And I say that with some hesitancy, because what we do know is that the vast majority of people, actually, when they become infected with this virus, don't get any illness at all. It doesn't make any difference if you become ill, if you get the milder illness, or if you get the more severe form of the illness. In all of those circumstances, your body actually mounts an immune response against the virus itself, which we can detect by doing a blood test. And so even at this point, a year after the fact, if we are able to identify that in your bloodstream you have antibodies that are specifically directed against the West Nile virus, that would be an indication that at some point you've been previously infected. We do know that West Nile was not present in the United States before 1999, although there are other similar types of viruses which have been here for many, many years, particularly one called St. Louis encephalitis. And so sometimes when we see indicators of immunity, they're not necessarily specific for West Nile, and some more specific testing would have to be done to determine which is the actual cause of the infection. But the bottom line is, yes, it's possible to see if that illness that you had last year may have been West Nile.
Right. And it seems to me I've been hearing something about a new test that was just approved that's faster and not too expensive. I mean, I don't know if it's a home test kit, but didn't the FDA approve something recently?
Right. It's not a home test kit. What it is, and it requires a little bit of background, what happens is when your body mounts an immune response against virtually any infection, you get two different types of antibodies. One type of antibody is the longer-term antibody, which is called IgG, immunoglobulin G. The other type is immunoglobulin M, IgM. And IgM tends to occur acutely after an infection, and then after a certain period of time tends to go away, and the IgG tends to stay behind. The assay, which was recently licensed by the Food and Drug Administration, is a serologic test, so it looks for the immune response, but it very specifically looks for the IgM. And what that indicates to us, if we see that particular test positive in somebody that has a compatible clinical illness, that's a pretty strong indication that would allow us to confirm that that illness is most likely to be West Nile.
All right, so maybe if I get it again this summer, that might work.
Well, you know, we believe, at least we think, that once you've had West Nile, you're unlikely to get it again, that the immunity that develops after a West Nile infection should be protective against the second infection. So I would say if you do become ill with a similar illness, and it turns out to be West Nile, it's unlikely that you had it the year before.
Okay. I don't want to do that assay, I'm afraid. But I do need
No, it's much better to protect yourself right. From being exposed to the mosquitoes that transmit the disease.
But I do not. Okay, but I'm gonna be protecting myself. But I do need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to some of our callers on this interesting topic. Scott in Chesapeake, Virginia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I was just wanted to sort of make a comment and sort of a question about mosquito control. I live in Chesapeake, Virginia, and there's quite a bit of, a large number of mosquitoes, and I also have small kids that just love to play outside. And in doing some research, I happened across something very interesting that I'm wondering about how prevalent or how feasible it would be to use it more for mosquito control, and that's helping to encourage bat colonies to live, in more wooded areas around where people live, because just one bat can eat, somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 insects per night. And, that's a pretty reasonable number of insects to, maybe help reduce the mosquito population. I wonder if that would, anybody's heard anything about whether that would be a feasible thing to maybe use for city, state, local governments to encourage residents to do that sort of thing.
Scott, interesting question. Thanks for your call. What about that, Dr. Ostroff?
Right, and that is a great question, and it's a question that we've heard on any number of occasions over the years since West Nile has been identified. In fact, I can remember a year or two ago that there were some youngsters that wanted to set out bats as part of their Boy Scout projects, thinking that it would help in terms of reducing the potential for there to be mosquitoes around that could transmit West Nile. The reason that we don't necessarily think that that's the best thing to do is that unfortunately there are other things that can be contracted from bats, and so the more bats that you have around your home environment, the more you have to be concerned about things like rabies. And so in terms of control measures to reduce mosquito populations, putting out more bats in an area is not necessarily one of our recommendations. We would much rather see the application of what we refer to as integrated pest control, which is the combination of what we call source reduction, looking for places where the mosquitoes breed and doing your best to try to eliminate those breeding sites, application of what's called larvicides, which are quite safe and keep the mosquitoes from hatching into adults themselves, and then taking a combination of personal protective measures to reduce your likelihood of being exposed to any mosquitoes that are out there.
All right. That's really what we're left with at the moment. I mean, there's no vaccine and there's no other kind of prevention of a technical nature, so it's mostly keep from getting bitten as much as you can.
Well, so far, obviously there's been a lot of work looking at the potential for specific therapeutics that could be used to treat the disease, and there is a lot of work going on looking at the potential for vaccines that would protect people from getting infected in the first place. The work on vaccines for humans is progressing quite nicely. It's still a couple of years off in terms of potentially having something that can be licensed by the Food and Drug Administration and used. It is important to note that right now we do have a vaccine that can protect horses, which is a great thing. We'd all like to be as far along as possible in terms of the human vaccine, but at least for the time being, it's this combination of doing what can be done to reduce mosquito populations, as well as protecting yourself from being bitten by mosquitoes. And I think even when a vaccine is available, since it wouldn't protect against some of the other diseases that can be transmitted by mosquitoes, it's still not going to take away the need to keep the mosquito populations down and protect yourself against being bitten.
Okay, Dr. Ostroff, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's very nice to talk to you.
Dr. Stephen Ostroff is Deputy Director of the National Center for Infectious Disease at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Earlier this hour, we spoke with Dr. Peter Buston from the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and Dr. Jillian Gregg, who's now at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Western Ecology Division in Corvallis, Oregon. This program is produced by Annette Heist, Adrian McDonald, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our interns are Erica Holland and Annalie Strachan. If you'd like to write to us, try email. It's scifry@npr.org. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.